Pleasure to be your speaker this afternoon, and as we continue our walk through the book of Acts, and as we consider the various things that happened as the New Testament church was introduced, and as Gentiles in particular were introduced as well to the gospel of Jesus. I used to watch The West Wing on TV. And like a lot of shows that are series of that nature, at the beginning, they would always announce previously on The West Wing, and then they would go through and show you a few clips that would either remind you where you were in the story, or if you missed last week, you could pretty quickly catch up and follow along with the storyline. So, previously in Acts, on various occasions, Paul has been questioned by Jewish leaders. And each time he answers, he seems to step in the middle of a skirmish of some kind. He causes a huge discussion, but also a pretty violent response by talking about the redemption of the Gentiles or the resurrection of the dead. And the chief captain, in this case, a fellow by the name of Claudius Lysias, he was not the emperor Claudius, so don't confuse that. He was perhaps using the name in some way to honor the emperor, but in reality, it was more likely he was doing it to gain political favor. This chief captain, Claudius, is embarrassed by this uprising that's happened, this big skirmish that Paul has essentially caused. He's embarrassed by it. He doesn't want word to get back to his superiors. So he's prepared to have Paul scourged, to question him. Paul points out, though, that he's a Roman. He's a citizen. And then Claudius moves to plan B. He takes Paul back before a loosely assembled version of the Sanhedrin, which he himself is overseeing. And it's there that Paul is illegally struck after making a comment at the direction of the chief priest. Paul then announces his resume as a Pharisee, and he brings up the resurrection, which the Pharisees loved, and immediately, strangely, come to Paul's defense. And the Sadducees hated it, and another food fight breaks out. Claudius steps in and rescues Paul from the mob. The Jewish leaders hate Paul, and they take an oath, pledging not to eat until Paul is dead. Had they known that that was a few years off, they probably would have liked to rethink that. But it does show you how fickle and how unhinged a mob can be. We see it even today with riots at ball games, social media. Emotions and anger and pride and selfishness and fear take over, and things get out of control. But Paul's sister gets word of the plan that they have put together to kill Paul, and she gets it relayed through someone else to Claudius. And now, let's read. We'll read it first through the Legacy Standard Version, and then we'll go back through in the New King James. And when he, Claudius, called to him two of the centurions, he said, "Make ready 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to proceed to Caesarea by the third hour of the night, and provide mounts to put Paul on, and bring him safely to Felix the governor." And he wrote a letter having this form: "Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came up to them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman, and wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their Sanhedrin. And I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. And when I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to speak against him before you. So the soldiers, according to their orders, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. But the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to their barracks. When these had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. And when he had read it, he asked from what province he was. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also, giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. So let's reread the first couple of verses. He called for two centurions, saying, prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night and provide mounts to set Paul on and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. So Claudius is going to send Paul to Felix, the governor. He's seen how angry the Jews are with Paul. He's heard that they are determined to kill him. So Claudius probably doesn't give a rip about Paul. For that matter, not really about anybody except himself. He's interested in his own political standing, his own reputation. The last thing he needs is for Rome to get wind of how out of control things are down in Judea. Rome doesn't want to hear about problems. But what he does want Rome to hear about is this get it done fella that they've got down in Judea running things. He also knows that the governor Felix is known to be on the take. So, why not leverage this opportunity for the governor to score a few extra bucks? He figures that'll come in handy about review time every year. Claudius spares no expense in rounding up a security force to get Paul safely to Caesarea, but also to put on a show of power and authority. Every commentator basically says this guy is a scoundrel. As a matter of fact, most of the characters, except for Paul in this story, are scoundrels. So the entire security force number going to take this one guy about 60 miles is 470 people. So the plan is to get Paul out of town under the cover of darkness. They leave at 9 p.m., which is well in advance of another requested meeting before the Sanhedrin, because the Jews wanted to have Paul brought back before them again. It was actually an occasion that they had planned out as a way to ambush and kill Paul. So, this forced and hurried march of about 35 miles, the first part of it, required several horses and donkeys for Paul, who's in chains, to ride on through the night into the next day. So they already know they're going a long ways. And so they said, basically, take enough donkeys or horses for this guy to ride on so we don't lose any time. So about Felix, the governor of Judea, not the guy from The Odd Couple. Felix is the governor or the procurator of Judea. He gained the office in 52 AD. So at the time of this episode that we're looking at today, in Acts 23, he's been in office about 5 years. Felix was a scoundrel. Paul was innocent. Felix came to that conclusion very quickly. It's what he had been told, but also what he came to find out. Paul should have been released immediately. But Felix was scheming because he wanted to get a fat bribe. So he held him captive. A quote regarding Felix that is provided by Kaufman and then also quoted by Joe Heisel. With savagery and lust, he exercised the powers of a king with the disposition of a slave. So Felix had been a slave under Antonia, the mother of Emperor Claudius. I have a thought here about leadership and the description of the leadership and character of Felix, which I think is a little bit of a side trip, but I want to make the point. Leadership should not be in the hands of those who are weak in spirit and character. Those whose primary existence has been in bondage are rarely equipped to effectively lead people. That's true in the literal and temporary sense, but also true in the spiritual realm. People whose baseline vantage point is one of bondage are often without perspective to lead people. They often take a selfish, immature, or simply populist path, rather than leading from a mature and selfless and virtuous purpose. Imagine someone released from federal prison immediately becoming mayor of a town. While redemption is, of course, desired and possible, without some heart-level transformation, consider what a flawed perspective of life from which they would lead. Not what's right, not what's in the long-term best interest of the people, but rather, what can I get away with? What can I use for my own advantage? That's the picture that we have of Felix, a small, conniving man. To the contrary, consider the qualifications for elders or other leaders in the Lord's church. We look for men without blame, those who exhibit character qualities formed by freedom. Not perfect men, but men who are considered blameless because they have led repentant lives and are therefore free. Those who are humble before men and before God because their standing before others has been affirmed by God, not through manipulation or through conniving means. Their humility contributes to strength of character. The main story of Acts, and specifically the work of Paul, was of course the enactment of God's redemptive plan for mankind. But I couldn't help think about this other lesson that seems to me to be sort of hiding in plain sight. Leadership matters. In churches, in organizations, in government, in business, it matters. And all of us, but certainly young people who have the desire, the talent, or the aspiration to lead others in life, should appreciate the value, the hard work on the development of the time-honored and even ancient character traits, like honesty or decency, humility, kindness, all of the things that are emphasized throughout Scripture and for certainly in Galatians, in the list of the attributes of the Spirit, the bedrock of effective and virtuous leadership. Verse 26, Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council. I found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him deserving of death or chains. And when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you, and I also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell. You can tell that his description doesn't exactly match reality. But how does Luke get a copy of this letter? It's hard to know. It could have been that Luke was actually with Paul as he was being moved to Caesarea. Some commentators suggest that. Perhaps someone later provided him a copy. Most assuredly, it's in Scripture because God wanted it there. So 2 Timothy 3:16 assures us that all Scripture is God-breathed, so by inspiration is a pretty easy and reliable answer as to how he knew what was in that letter. It's clear in this letter to Felix that Claudius doesn't mind leaving out a few facts here and there to sweeten the story, or to embellish some things that make himself look better. For example, the truth is, Claudius has Paul in chains. He's ready to scourge the guy, practically kill him, to question him. Fails to mention that, because he realizes later he was a citizen, which would have been a huge mistake on behalf of Claudius. He's not the white knight protecting the Roman citizens, as he wants to suggest in this letter. He is one slimy dude who's writing to another slimy dude. Then the soldiers, as they were commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. The next day they left the horsemen to go on with him and returned to the barracks. When they came to Caesarea and had delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. It seems that overnight the party escorting Paul made it about halfway, roughly about 30 miles or so. The next day they travel another 30 miles. Now some suggest it actually took them a couple of days. Doesn't really matter. It was a long ways to go without stopping. And it was a long, hard trip. Bowles comments that they entered Caesarea in daylight, and such a parade would have attracted many curious eyes. Philip and the other Christians residing in Caesarea must have been startled to recognize the rapid fulfillment of prophecy concerning Paul's journey to Jerusalem. Because you'll remember, Paul was discouraged from going to Jerusalem in the first place. Others prophesying that there was going to be trouble waiting for him in Jerusalem, perhaps even death for Paul. 34 to 35. And when the governor had read it, he asked what province he was from. And when he understood that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear you when your accusers have also come." And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's praetorium, also translated castle. So Felix asked Paul first, basically, where are you from? That's actually a pertinent question, because he needed to ask to make sure that Paul was actually really under his jurisdiction. It's presumed that Felix delayed acting so that he could come up with a plan as a way to bribe Paul or some of his friends to pay money to basically get him out of jail. However, Paul, interestingly enough, is not treated as a vicious criminal. Instead, he's provided accommodations in Herod's palace. And it would be his home for the next 2 years. It's during this time period that Luke would travel throughout Galilee, Judea, and Samaria, preparing to write the Gospel of Luke. While the delay for Paul was no doubt frustrating, I suppose we can be grateful today for the nature of his accommodations, especially when you compare it to the treatment that he had gotten in previous times in life and that he would get toward the end of his life. So, a couple of takeaways. In addition to how I was struck by the example of poor leadership and the way that that trickles down and affects everyone who is in the charge of leaders who have a mission that is flawed or character that is flawed, I had the same takeaway about kind of what we've studied in Acts so far, the incredible story of God's power and his determined will that the gospel message would survive no matter what. that it was protected throughout lots of ups and downs, bumps and bruises, that it would prosper against considerable forces. I also think that the Jewish leaders offer us a lesson and a warning. Their downfall was pride. It blinded them from the truth. Even in moments where you could see that the truth would sneak in, their pride would quickly snuff it out. They were oblivious to what God was actually doing, what His will actually was. They were completely oblivious to God's heart and what He wanted, because they couldn't see beyond their own pride and their own traditions. They were concerned about how they looked, how they were respected, and they placed those obsessions over and above what God actually wanted or desired. So even when they were accurate about something, the leading Jews lacked the Spirit. And Jesus makes it clear in John 4 that the twin towers of Spirit and in truth matter greatly, that they are essential in worship and in allegiance to God. Not only in worship, but attention to truth and Spirit should guide our lives, our decision making, the relationships that we have as we strive to follow the Lord. Today we're benefited by having the full story. We have the full story of the gospel, but we can be just as susceptible to pride. A humble spirit will enable our eyes to see and our ears to hear. That's the lesson for today. We offer you the invitation, the very invitation that Paul was effectively giving his life for, so that we, predominantly Gentiles, could hear that message. And we are grateful to the Lord today that that message not only has been preserved, but is as powerful today as it was when it was first offered. And so we offer you the gospel invitation as we stand and sing.